to order. June 14th, 3 p.m. Cletus, are you ready for us yet? You've been waiting all session.
All session.
We have.
He ought to be a racehorse, just ready to go.
Send him to the county official.
We're going to not take the bills in the order that they're on here. I want to get Senator George up on, had opened a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1064A. Can you give us a brief summary of what the bill is, does?
I would, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1064 comes to us from the Senate side with a 26-aye vote, 3 excused from the chamber floor. The bill establishes that a person receiving developmental disability services has the right to be informed that a family member has contacted the Department of Human Services to determine the person's location and to be informed of the name and contact information of the family member. We have chief sponsors of the bill here to provide additional background, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that's fine. Senator George.
Good to be here with you. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. So good to be over here with you guys. And I'd like to tell you a little story about this bill relative to my family. Many years ago, a beautiful little girl was born to my sister, and we discovered at the time the child was born that the cords had wrapped around her neck in the latter hours of the pregnancy. And it didn't take us very long to realize that this beautiful child was, in fact, very much brain damaged. And later, a decision was made by the family to place her in a state home. And from that point on, those of us who were closer to her age, because the sister I'm mentioning was 10 years older than I, and so this was like my little sister. And the sad part is that I never did, nor did many of the other children get to see this little girl again. And when this bill was brought forward, it just brought up so much heartache because of the fact that there was no closure. When she passed away in state hands, and the family was not able to attend what would be a normal service for a member of your family. So when Peter Courtney brought this bill forward, I was so excited, because what better thing than to reunite families prior to the time of the passage of that person. And I have with me, I talked to David as we were across the street for the flag ceremony, and David actually knew Molly in Fairview. And David, you want to introduce yourself?
Tell Mr. Chairman and the speakers, both sides. My name is David Beam. I'm an advocate for special needs population to the state of Oregon, for the ones that are not getting served in the state. A lot of disability people don't like the system out there too much because they don't know where all the services are in the state. But Molly, she was in the institution with me at Fairview Group Homes and at the state hospital. The state hospital people come out of there in Fairview as good friends to each other. Molly, she had a good life out there, and she had a good family and sport. But I didn't have any support like Molly didn't. I had a lot of families against me when I was institutionalized. But this system is dead wrong in the state of Oregon. I think the state of Oregon needs to do a better system in there for the rest of the state. So pass this bill for Molly, and I think we should do it now for Molly's sake.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just before we came here, David and I were talking about his brother, and his brothers, now that David is out of the system and is actually out on his own doing very well independent, his brother has played a very important role in his life as far as supporting him and almost everything that he tries to do. That's the story that we want to hear over and over again. I know what it meant to me not to have contact with my niece, and I know what it meant to her sisters and her cousins and to my older sister not to have contact with that child. And I think this is just a great time to complete the circle and have a particularly provide an opportunity for the families to attempt to make that connection. Okay. Sure, thank you.
Catherine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, which is an organization that includes providers, families, individuals with disabilities, and advocates. And many of our folks experience firsthand some of the human cost of our social policy toward people with disabilities that resulted in segregation, isolation, and the separation of families. It was policy and on the advice of physicians that many families who had a child with a disability gave that child up and put them in places like Fairview Training Center. There were few community supports. It was often sort of a Sophie's choice. Families were advised that for the sake of their child with a disability and for the sake of the rest of the family members that they should give their children up and think of them, frankly, as dead. The attitudes towards disability have changed. We now have access to public education and other supports and services. Many of the families, many of the parents who made those very difficult decisions are dying, and their children are discovering, in fact, that they had siblings. Others are deciding that they want to reconnect with this lost child before they die, and we are getting increasing requests from individuals seeking out that sibling or that child who was placed 20, 30, maybe even 40 years ago. What this bill would do would simply make it possible, similar to sort of an adoption registry, make it possible for those individuals to come to the Department of Human Services, indicate an interest in identifying and finding the individual with disability, and the department would be able to reconnect them. The bill would establish that the department would, by rule, establish the parameters and the process for that reconnection. There is no fiscal cost on the bill. The reason for the bill is that under many of the confidentiality regulations that currently exist, there was some ambiguity as to the appropriate process. This bill basically avoids that and gives clarification to the individuals at the Department of Human Services that that reconnection can occur. Some of it has occurred informally in the past, but the department supports the bill to make this easier to do. I've also handed out to you testimony that is being submitted by Jeffrey West of Tigert, Oregon, who on hearing the news stories, the passage of the bill on the Senate side, there was news coverage, his family chose to attempt to find a brother that they had not seen in many, many years, 66. And that family of many brothers and sisters, and the parents are still alive, have reconnected with their brother in Baker. And I'll answer any questions.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see this get passed on the both sides on the floor, because it would be good for disability people in the state of Oregon. Wouldn't that happen again in the state of Oregon? Thank you.
We appreciate you taking time to come tell us what's happened. If we haven't had a family member that something like that's happened to, you kind of, it's off to the side, you don't see it, you don't think about it, when you become affected, then all of a sudden it affects people's lives for their entire life. So, no further questions at all? Okay, thank you very much. You're the only two that signed up. Was there anyone else signed up for this bill that didn't want to testify, that didn't sign up? Okay. Mr. Boquist, to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 10.
Do we have a work session?
I open both.
Okay.
Yeah. Public hearing and work session. 1064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Pearson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Senate Bill 1064A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Flores, would you carry the bill?
Love to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 806. Senator George.
For the record again, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12.
Gary, just hold just a second.
Oh. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 806A comes to you from the other side of the Senate Judiciary Committee, originally sponsored by Senator George, includes a private nonprofit organization providing transportation services within the definition of public body. It requires a nonprofit corporation providing transportation services receive more than 50% of its funding for transportation services from the state of Oregon or political subdivision. It extends the state's tort claims limitations only for those providing public transportation services.
Senator George, now you can have that.
Thank you. Now we'll get it right. Thank you very much. Again, for the record, State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. Last year I had an opportunity to serve on a county transportation committee, primarily dealing with the issue of transit. And we begin to realize we have private nonprofits and other providers out there that are providing that link that is necessary to make a system work. As you folks know, ever since I've been here, since 1997, I have been interested in transportation and providing a mechanism to allow transit to survive and to function. This is really a survival bill because with the additional costs that many of our providers are facing, even the small cost of insurance, which to them may not seem that small, can become the difference between providing service and absolutely failing. So we came up with this idea, and this bill was brought to us, and we supported the concept. We were able to gain the support of the trial lawyers with this bill, which was we were very happy to have that support. And as you can see, we had good success on the Senate floor in getting this bill passed. Now I'm going to turn it over to the expert who really knows what's happening.
My name is Doug Bartlett, and I represent Community Action Agency of Yamhill County, often known as YCAP. We do public transit services in Yamhill County, and it's a privilege to be able to be here. I have submitted some letters and information from others who were not able to be here on short notice. Some of these are current letters that were just written yesterday or today. Others are ones that were submitted for consideration by the House, by the Senate Judiciary Committee. They include a letter from one of our county commissioners, Commissioner Lester. The earlier letter from them actually was signed by all three county commissioners, two Republicans and a Democrat. The next letter is from Jay Lynch from Oregon Housing and Associated Services, who does the wheels service in Salem and Marion and Polk counties. The next one is a letter from Margaret Davidson, who is headquartered in La Grande, Oregon. And the next one is Barbara Brown from Chehalem Valley in Newburgh. This is a fairly simple bill, and we have worked to restrict it so that it only applies to transit providers that are nonprofits that receive the majority of their funds from government sources. In other words, who are legitimately doing a government service, a government function. We've also restricted it so that it only applies to the organizations in their transit functions. We do other things besides transit, but the Oregon Tort Claims Protection would not apply to those other services. It only applies to the transit services. And so it's really tried to restrict it down to nonprofits that are kind of caught in the bind of doing a public service on behalf of governmental agencies in order to, in a sense, stretch the dollars as far as they can and yet are outside of the tort claims protection. So we request your serious consideration and passage of it.
Okay. Committee members, you have some questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this cover, I'm just thinking of a recent case I saw in the paper where a driver of a vehicle was molesting somebody. I'm assuming this is like for traffic accidents more than something like that, or am I?
We operate under the federal transit rules and regulations with regard to hiring and training and supervision of our personnel. I'm not a lawyer, so it's hard for me to actually answer that question. It is not an issue that affects actual claims or damages. That's not the portion of protection that it provides. Anybody that's hurt, it's their physical problem or their hospitalizations, those are covered entirely. It is the liability portion that is the protection.
Committee members?
Bill? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to help in that question, it could very well cap liability in those issues, but that gets into a very interesting analysis. If I can remember my case law correctly, if you were dealing with kids, the Oregon Supreme Court, I don't know the case name, but it related to Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts. They said that when you're dealing with kids, you don't go through the normal analysis that you would, for example, in an employer-employee situation. Now, the situation you're talking about, I believe, is a devoutly disabled young lady who was over the age of 18. When you're dealing with the normal situation of employment, it's an issue of whether the employer was negligent in hiring or negligent in retention. When you're dealing with kids and possibly disabled people, you're talking a different analysis. What it would do, it would cap liability in those situations as it relates to the employer, but it would not as it relates to the employee. Because what you're talking is an intentional tort.
Mr. Chair, just as further comment in regard to Representative Barker's incident or example, that driver was driving for an education service district, not for a nonprofit. But if you use it, for example, as a bus driver for a nonprofit, then I understand the analogy.
Thank you. Anything further? I'm going to let you off easy. Thank you. Phil Donovan? I would have seen your name earlier, Phil, I'd have got you up at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Directors of Oregon. Frankly, I was here to basically support my client, Doug Rutlett, and given that he'd already testified with Senator George, I don't really have anything further to add.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Committee members, any of you received emails or correspondence regarding this bill? I've got two or three. Yeah. Maybe it's because they know it's coming here. Okay, we'll close the public hearing. We're going to have to jump around to accommodate some of the legislators that we've got waiting. We're going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 489.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 489A comes to you sponsored by Senator Courtney and Representative Dalto. This measure deals with appeals of final orders of the Public Utility Commission. The current law is that an order of the Public Utility Commission is appealed to the Marion County Circuit Court, and then from the Marion County Circuit Court, the next layer of appeal is to the Court of Appeals. Under current law, at the Court of Appeals, the court can completely disregard the record that was made at the trial court level. It's called de novo review. This measure would significantly change that process. The process under this measure would be that the order of the PUC could be appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. And that appeal process would be governed by the Administrative Procedures Act, which is codified in Chapter 183 of the Oregon Revised Statute. There is a -A3 amendment that is before you that deals with a specific sub-issue, and that is when a party is seeking a stay of a PUC order. The under the dash A3, the rule would be that the party could seek that stay directly from the Court of Appeals. And there would also be a provision for bond, for notice and a hearing. My understanding of the current law is that the current law would be a request of a stay of the search court for Marion County as well. So this essentially makes the process consistent, whether or not the party is seeking an appeal of a final order and or a stay of a final order.
Mr. Chairman.
Right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Billy Dalter, State Representative for Oregon's 21st House District, and with the indulgence of the chairman and the committee members, I just soon bring everybody up here so we can move through this and get on to your rest of your agenda. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I want to thank you for scheduling this for a work session and for the public hearing, and also thank the speaker for accommodating us. This is a good government bill, very simple. What it does is streamlines the process of these appeals, PUC appeals, when you have a ratepayer that is involved in a service that's regulated by the PUC and has a complaint, for example, a telephone bill, a complaint about their charge on their phone bill. They go to the administrators. They go to the PUC to lodge the complaint. There's an administrative law process that takes place once they get there. Administrative law judge reviews it. They may decide that there isn't the complaint isn't substantiated, but if it is. There's some kind of finding in the administrative law procedure, and those typically are appealed automatically to the Marion County Circuit Court. Marion County Circuit Court then reviews these cases. The record from the administrative law procedure in the Marion County Circuit Court will make a decision based on the facts of the case. Then, if the parties then decide to appeal from that point forward, they can go to the Court of Appeals. And once it gets to the Court of Appeals, it's pretty interesting. It gets to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals cannot look at, by statute, the record that's generated in the Marion County Circuit Court. They must refer back to the administrative law court to be able to review the record. And so it's a wasted step. It's a burden on this Marion County Circuit Court, which is already charged with all sorts of interesting cases that the legislature sends its way. This would really streamline government, really help Marion County, and I urge your positive consideration of this bill. I'd like to introduce Judge Paul Lipscomb.
Representative Dalto, do you want to answer any questions they might have so you can get back to the floor? You're welcome to stay if you want.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to stay to make sure this is done. Thank you very much.
Judge Lipscomb.
Good afternoon, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for accommodating us here. I'm Paul J. Lipscomb. I'm the presiding judge, Marion County Circuit Court. Marion County Circuit Court is a very busy court. We get a lot of extra state work, and we don't get any additional positions or funds to deal with that. These tend to be very large cases, not routine cases, and yet when you look at our book of business in terms of the statistical book, it looks the same as everybody else's. So it's really not comparing apples to apples, oranges to oranges. I'm not here to complain about our lot in life, though I'm very grateful for the position I have, and I think Marion County is the best place to serve. But you could help us out here a little bit by taking away a chunk of business that for us really is pretty meaningless. We are charged by law, under current law, with reviewing these cases that come to us from the Public Utility Commission after a contested case hearing where all the parties have had an opportunity to be heard before the PUC. The cases have to then come for review at the circuit court level, but we are reviewing the case on the record made in the state agency, in the PUC. And then the appeal from our court goes to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals also looks to the record before the PUC, not to the record that's made in our circuit court. So there's no value added by that step. It's just a needless delay in the procedures of the appeal from the agency determination. So it adds to the cost of the litigation, it adds to the delay in the litigation, it costs the taxpayers, costs the ratepayers. The only people that benefit from this procedure are the lawyers. and they've got plenty of business before the PUC and before the Court of Appeals, and they don't need to make another stop in our court. Once before, when I was testifying about this, it would be as if we were attempting to get something done in Washington, D.C. But before going to Washington, D.C., we'd have to stop off in Cleveland for 6 months or a year before we could go on to Washington, D.C. to get something addressed. That's pretty much the same situation here. It is a six-month delay, usually at the minimum, and it can be as long as a year and a half or even 2 years, depending on how complicated the cases are. Many of these cases are quite complicated, can involve the rate base in Trojan, and that's a case I had, can involve the rate base in the telecommunications industry and how they allot the costs when there's a new carrier enters the fray and wants to utilize the telephone lines that are already existing in the public domain, and what kind of charges should they be paying for the telephone poles, et cetera. There are very large cases. If I'd had more time, I would have brought one or two of them over just to show you. But for us, they're basically take-home cases. So this really is good for everyone. It's good for the taxpayers. It's good for the ratepayers. It's just good government, and it actually shrinks government rather than increasing it. So I would urge you to look favorably upon this and get it out to the floor of the House. It's passed the House on several occasions in several previous sessions, but it's never, and it's passed the Senate this time. It's never passed both the House and the Senate in the same session, and I'd sure like to get this bill out before I retire. I think it's been four or six sessions, something like that, that I've been over here trying to get this done. And I come by this gray hair naturally. That's it.
The ending deals that are being
made. Thank you, Representative Krieger. We can't make any deals. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Teresa? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Teresa Miller representing PGE, and we just wanted to be here to support the bill. And the Dash A3 amendments are PGE's amendments. As our attorneys looked over the bill, they felt like the issue of requests for a stay was overlooked, and they just wanted to make sure those were addressed and that any of those requests would go to the Court of Appeals. So that's what our amendment does, and it's really the Dash 3 amendment that we've got before us. So if there's any questions about the amendment, I'd be happy to address those. But otherwise, we support the bill.
Committee members? Reverend McPherson, you got the look on your eye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, Ms. Miller, about the effect of the A3 amendment. I understand that there's a fuller discussion in the bill as passed by the Senate about what would have to be shown in order to get a stay, and that's being replaced by just the general reference for cause shown. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, my understanding is that we made this change from the Dash 2 to the Dash 3 amendment because we wanted to make sure the standard did not change, and the current standard for granting a stay is for cause shown, and we wanted to make sure that that remained consistent. At least that's my understanding. I think it was more of just a clarification on our attorney's part to make sure we're not changing the standard.
Mr. Leary, do you
have anything? Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, just to add to Ms. Miller's comments, that under the bill right now, if the bill were to become law, the procedure for a stay would be governed by the Administrative Procedures Act. That's Chapter 183. And the standard that a person would have to show to get a stay would be a showing of irreparable injury to the petitioner and a colorable claim of error in the order. That's very different than the current law. The current law is governed by 756.590, and that is the order, the stay can be granted for cause shown. And what the A3 does is maintain that for cause shown standard and make clear that the request for the stay can go directly to the Court of Appeals.
Any further questions yet?
No, I think I understood just to recite what I'm hearing. It's that the A3 amendments are to avoid a change in the law that would occur if we were to pass the bill as it came out of the Senate.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Beyer, Mark Nelson, and Sean Miller, please. Mr. Beyer, if you get any brighter tie, we may not allow you to test it.
You know, with these days, you need a little color.
Yes, you do.
Particularly in my business.
Yes. Go ahead and start, whoever wants to.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I've handed out testimony. I won't go over that. I think suffice to say that we support the judge's request here. I think it will save ratepayers money, and I think it will save the participants in our process, both on the consumer advocates and the utility side money in terms of processing. This really is a streamlining process, and I think it's good law.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Pacific Corp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power, and we also support Senate Bill 49 with the Dash 3 amendments. We appreciate Representative Dalto pushing hard to get this bill. It has been a long time coming, and we would urge the committee to pass the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, members of the committee. I represent industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. We, as well as PGE and Pacific Corp, continually have lawyers representing our interests before the PUC, as you can tell by this bill, also before the Circuit Court and then the Court of Appeals. We strongly urge your support for this bill. It will save a countless number of hours and dollars, and for the I think the betterment of all involved, no matter what side you're on a particular PUC issue.
Okay, committee members, you have any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 489.
Representative Boquist has moved that we adopt the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 489. Any objections? Not so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 489 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 49.
I thought we were just in public hearing on that.
I want to vote. Okay. Yeah, we got permission from the Speaker to move it. 489A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Okay, Barker.
Aye.
Okay, Boquist.
Aye.
Okay, Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Pearson. Aye.
Chair
Krieger. Aye. Senate Bill 49A, as amended, moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative McPherson, would you carry?
Be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to carry it? What? Representative Dalton will carry it, if that's all right.
Me.
That okay, Representative McPherson?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dalton. I'm sorry, that's fine.
And if there's a problem, you two can fight over it.
Okay.
And Representative Barker, you're going to need a quorum on the floor, so we need to have one of you go to make the quorum. She's going.
Okay.
If you could do that, please. And if we have a controversial thing come up, we'll hold it.
Okay.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing and possible work session on, and a work session on, House Bill 3492. And do we have a sign-up sheet on that?
Mr. Chair and Committee, HB 3492 provides that murder of reserve officer that is related to performance of the officer's official duties is aggravated murder. In current law, reserve officers are meant as an officer or member of a law enforcement unit who is a volunteer or who is employed less than full-time as a police officer, commissioned by a city, port, school district, mass transit district, county services district to provide law enforcement services, including Indian reservations, the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice, and the Oregon State Lottery Commission under governor, or who is a member of the Department of State Police,
who is armed with a firearm and is responsible for enforcing the criminal laws and traffic of the state of Oregon or laws or ordinances related to airport security. Currently, reserve officers are not listed under the ORS 165.095 and 163.105, aggravated murder.
Okay, we need to have Mr. Stega and Kelly Skye, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of Oregon's Catholic bishops in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians in support of the common good for all. Mr. Chair, we appear today on House Bill 3492 in opposition to the bill and ask this committee to table this bill. This issue has been before the legislature in the past, and as we have on other bills that would act to expand the death penalty this session, we appear before you asking for the abolition of the death penalty rather than its expansion. And our testimony indicates no disrespect for reserve officers. We respect police officers, those who are first responders, those in law enforcement. But we think that this bill is on the wrong side of history, quite frankly. I've handed to you a copy of materials from the Catholic campaign to end the use of the death penalty. On March 21st, the U.S. Catholic bishops launched a national campaign to end the use of the death penalty. For about 30 years, now 25 years, the U.S. Catholic bishops have been prominent in their opposition to the death penalty. Pope John Paul II made a major effort during his years as Pope to end the death penalty. As a matter of fact, when he appeared in St. Louis in 1999, he renewed his appeal for a consensus to end the death penalty. Some interesting facts about the death penalty is over the last 30 years or so, more than 100 people who were convicted of a capital offense have been exonerated. Given modern means of penology, we believe that there are alternatives to the death penalty which do not perpetuate the cycle of violence. In the Bishop's press conference on March 21st, if I might point out to you the statement in the packet of Bud Welch, the father of Julie Marie Welch, who was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing of March 21st. And I thought his statement was quite illustrative of a person responding to a death of a family member with the utmost compassion. He said in his statement, "In the months following Julie's death, I was one of many seeking vengeance for the people who took my daughter. I turned to alcohol and cigarettes to ease my pain. I was angry with God for allowing this terrible thing to happen to me. But after several months, I began to hear Julie's voice. Years before, as a child herself, I remember her telling me that she thought that executions only taught children to hate. With the realization that losing a child is a terrible burden, I began to understand that Tim McVeigh's dad, Bill, would soon be facing the same pain when the government executed his son. I reached out to Bill and his daughter, Jennifer, and that experience strengthened my conviction that we do not need to use the death penalty in this country. My conviction is simple. More violence is not what Julie would have wanted. More violence will not bring Julie back. More violence only makes our society more violent." Mr. Chair and members of the committee, each great journey begins with one step. And in the recent legislative sessions, those of us in the religious community and in coming from other perspectives have been successful in preventing bills that would expand the death penalty from moving through the legislative process. And I have no great crystal ball, but I suspect that that will also be true this session. What I would ask you to do in this committee on this bill is to table this bill. It's very easy for you to advance the bill, but I'm asking you to use your conscience beyond politics to table this bill to indicate that Oregon wants to be part of the global effort to stop capital punishment. If you look at the European Union, one of the issues with Turkey's admission to the European Union was whether or not Turkey would abandon the death penalty. This is a global effort, and Oregon needs to be part of this global movement. So I would appeal to you today to table this bill. Thank you very much.
Kelly?
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Sky, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I've spoken to a number of you about this issue before involving other bills. The Criminal Defense Lawyers Association opposes this bill. We oppose the death penalty, and we strongly oppose any expansion to the death penalty. We already have a very expansive death penalty statute in the state of Oregon. There are 18 ways that a person can commit the crime of aggravated murder. And we, too, have no disrespect for a reserve officer and don't like to see a differentiation in the value of human life, whether you're a police officer, a reserve officer, or a civilian on the street. What we are concerned about is that every session someone comes before the legislature and feels that they need to be added to the list of people for whom killing will bring about the death penalty. And at some point we have to draw a line and decide that our list is long enough and perhaps start looking at that list and thinking of ways to shrink it, to reduce the number of ways that a person can commit a crime that will result in the death penalty. I'm sure that you all know that the death penalty is one of the most expensive parts of our criminal justice system. And the appeals process is lengthy, and it needs to be in order to ensure that constitutional rights and of the defendants are protected. But if you apply to that an evidence-based best practice analysis, you will find that this is money that's not being well spent. We're not executing people in the state of Oregon, but we're spending a lot of money prosecuting them, both the Judicial Department, the defense, the prosecution are all spending too much money in this area, and I think it's a good time for us to draw the line, not expand the death penalty any further, and to start to look at ways that we can reduce the use of the death penalty in the state of Oregon.
Committee members, do you have any questions, comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sky, is there anything about the status of a reserve officer that is distinguishable from a police officer? That is, would a reserve officer be readily identified as such to the perpetrator of a crime? I realize this departs from the sort of line of analysis you were going through, but I'm just curious about whether they look the same, act the same as a police officer, or they're distinguishable.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I really couldn't answer that question. I don't believe that there is, but I'm really not in a position to answer that.
I think, Representative McPherson, for the most part, when they're actually out with the deputy or the city PD, they have a uniform and probably, it's reserve or whatever it might be. Representative Barker, is that your experience?
Yeah, the patch just says reserve and the badge is slightly different, but to somebody just seeing them, you really...
They wouldn't know that there is a difference. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon also want their go on record and indicate its opposition to this bill.
Okay, fine. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else signed up? Is no one else signed up for the bill? Is there anyone there?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3492 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Reverend Boquist has moved House Bill 3492 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Would you like to carry it?
Sure.
Okay, we'll have Representative Barker carry it. So House Bill 3492 has moved to the floor with a do pass. Open work session on House Bill 3495. Public hearing and work session.
Mr. Chair and committee. House Bill 3495 permits manufacturers of malt beverages that have privileged tax liability of less than $1,000 per tax period to deposit with Oregon Liquor Control Commission funds equal to the tax liability in the prior period in lieu of posting required bonds. Before you, HB 3495-1, amendment to this bill, and the difference between the actual bill and the amendment is the department brought to attention of the requesters that in the bill it says tax period. If you look at line 8 on the actual bill itself, and you'll see where it says tax period, that has been changed to reflect calendar year, so because they do their bill on a monthly basis, and this provides for the entire tax period, which would be 1 year. So that was a change in the amendment to provide for that liability based on the tax calendar year.
Okay, who's second up on that? Bill Ferry, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association. The Oregon Brewers Guild, which is the Microbreweries Association, came to the beer and wine wholesalers and us to talk about this problem. And so we offered assistance to help it. What has happened in this situation is anybody that collects taxes for the state of Oregon is required to post a bond. The minimum bond required by the OLCC is $1,000. Well, to achieve a $1,000 bond, you have to pay $100 up front. And there are actually 5 breweries in Oregon that collect less than $100 in taxes. There are several of them that are in about the $200 to $250 range. And so what has happened is they're paying $100 to pay, you know, about $200 in taxes. So what we did was say you have a choice under this piece of legislation. So you can either buy the bond like is normally required, or you can just pay whatever your previous tax year's taxes up front, and then the OLCC can just deduct from. So you don't have to pay an extra $100 to be the tax collector for the state of Oregon. So once again, it gives the brewery a choice. They can either take what they've got today, or they can pay their taxes up front. And the OLCC came to us with the -1 amendments just because the tax period under their interpretation was a month instead of a year, and so we gladly accept the -1 amendments.
Okay. Any members have any questions? Okay, thank you, Bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the -1 amendment to House Bill 3495 be adopted.
Representative Boquist has moved the -1 amendments into House Bill 3495. Any objections? If not, they're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3495 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 3495 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Objections? Call the roll, please.
President Barker?
Aye.
President Boquist?
Aye.
President Flores?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye.
Chair Pearson?
Aye. House Bill 3495 as amended moves the floor with a due pass. And Representative Boquist, would you carry?
Delighted.
Have a public hearing on Senate Bill 66.
James Chair. Hey, how are you doing?
I'm going to end up with every.
We've got a staff carousel up there in the second row, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 66 directs the State Parks and Recreation Department to adopt rules that establish standards that the department is to use when dispersing monies to federally recognized Indian tribes for park and recreation programs. This bill was passed in the Senate on a 27-1 vote, made it through the House Environment Committee, and was re-referred to committee on June 3rd, re-referred to this committee. I'm like correct. This bill has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay, who we got here? Janet Tindall, Justin Martin, and Mike Mason, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. Thank you very much for hearing us today, and we are here to urge your support of Senate Bill 66. The passage of Senate Bill 66 continues to institutionalize the government-to-government relationship, ensuring that the goodwill and future vision found here in Oregon between the tribes and the states will continue. Senate Bill 66 is consistent with Senate Bill 770, which was a landmark piece of legislation for both the tribes and the state, and was passed in thanks to some of the members of the committee in 2001. Oregon's situation is truly unique. from Governor Attia's forward thinking in the creation of the Commission on Indian Services to Governor Kitzhaber's executive order looking at government-to-government relations, and the Legislative Assembly's passage of Senate Bill 770, ensuring government-to-government in statute, and currently during the present day, the work that is being done, Oregon is truly a model state when it comes to state-tribal relations. We believe Senate Bill 66 would carry that forward. The state and tribes are showing by example the productive results that can come from reciprocal communication, education, and cooperation. Thank you again for your time today, and we urge your support of Senate Bill 66.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Tindall. I'm the Assistant Director for the Parks and Recreation Department, and I am here to also ask your support of this bill. We actually had submitted this as a legislative concept at the request of our Assistant Attorney General, and his request to get our statutes consistent so that it would allow us to grant funds from our recreation grants programs to federally recognized tribal governments. We do have four recreation grant programs, and they're listed on the handout I provided you, so I won't go over them. These grants are awarded on a competitive basis. They are scored by independent committees, and they do provide some great recreation opportunities at the local level that the state park system cannot do. By giving grants to tribal governments, we would be able to have public recreation on some of these unique tribal lands. The requirements for the grant are that they are open to public in perpetuity. If for some reason that should end, then they would be required to refund the money to us. And there's one unique program that we are looking at. It's actually on the back of the handout. That is a proposal from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Round that would put in a 25-mile hiking, mountain bike, and equestrian trail that follows the historic Tillamook-Hebo Trail, which was used by both Native Americans and settlers from going to the valley and the coast and returning. This would be a great opportunity for Yamhill County, and their commissioner who came to testify during the grant review process was strongly in support of this, and we urge your support as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Krieger and members of the State and Federal Affairs Committee, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, also to support Senate Bill 66. We think this is a significant bill for, again, bringing the state and the tribes closer. As you're probably aware, the Warm Springs have a reservation of 660,000 acres. They own an additional 130,000 acres in Central Oregon. There are a number of tribal parks that they own, and some that they are considering developing. This is, I think, an important trade that's set up in Senate Bill 66, where a modest amount of state dollars can be provided to the tribes, and in exchange, the tribes open those parks not just to the tribal members, but to the entire public. So it is, I think, positive for both the state, local communities, and the tribes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any members, do you have any questions? There, since it was sent back to this committee from the floor, have you had any discussion with Representative Jensen or anyone who had concerns about the bill, that they expressed what their concerns specifically were?
Mr. Chair, I believe that there was some concerns about the tax rolls implications and also whether or not they would be, in fact, open to the public. They will, in fact, be open to the public. The tax roll questions I'm not able to address, but perhaps one of these gentlemen.
In the agreement that you might have, would it allow just, would it be a fee to use the park that's open for the public, and it would include just the new parks, or would it include the existing ones for public that maybe aren't now? I don't know. I have no idea.
Mr. Chair, any of our grant recipients can charge a modest fee to help offset some of their operational costs. That's a standard. But the fee would have to be a reasonable cost, and it would have to be applied to everyone.
Okay.
Chair Krieger, as far as the, you know, I have had a couple of discussions with Representative Jensen regarding the tax issues and with other members. As it stands now, and again, this is a complicated area, I'll try to keep it brief. Tribal members pay federal income tax regardless of where they live. Tribal members pay state income tax if they either live off of a reservation or Indian trust lands or work off of the reservation. So the great majority of tribal members in Oregon pay state income tax, pay taxes as other citizens do, partly because in the case of the restored tribes on the west side and the Klamath, there's very little housing. There's not much in the way of residential reservation. I mean, most of those reservation areas are timber reservation or timberlands that are there specifically for economic development primarily. They're not there for people to reside on. So the great majority of members, Warm Springs, the majority of their members live on the reservation, but many of them, especially with the current economic depression on the Warm Springs, many of them work off reservation. They thus are paying state income tax. So, you know, it's a minority that don't pay. But again, I think the issue here is you get a benefit for the whole people of Oregon by opening up these parks to them, just as if you had a state-to-state compact with the state of Washington, you know, for use of parks.
Any members have anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on a general characterization, because these are lottery funds, would you say that tribal members participate in the lottery as much as other Oregonians? They buy tickets, so on and so forth. General characterization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, as much as any other citizen of Oregon, I would imagine that they would participate. Again, that's speculation, but I would imagine that you are correct.
And if I may, Chair Krieger and Representative Boquist, you know, gambling is a very long tradition in Indian country, and we could have a long discussion about Celilo Falls and the way of life that existed prior to our ancestors coming here. But I can assure you that the Warm Springs members are active participants with the lottery.
Thank you. Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Tindall, is there authority for the department to condition a grant made under these programs for development of a trail on tribal lands, conditioning the grant upon access for the general public, for non-tribal members, and maybe other members of the panel would want to comment too, but I was curious whether you had that information.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that is part of the grant program, and that's the administrative rules are that any of these properties, any grant recipient, must hold it open for public access.
Okay.
Anything further? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all we got on that one. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 66. And we're going to drop down to Senate Bill 736. Representative Anderson, were you here for that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under current law, there's an exemption for ethanol production facilities from major portions of the state energy facility site certification process. This bill would expand the current exemption to include biodiesel production facilities that would use waste cooking oil, oil seeds, or cellulosic biomass such as grass straw as their feedstock. Any facility seeking this exemption would have to have already obtained all necessary local land use approvals and meet any applicable statewide planning goals and rules. And they must make a formal application to the State Energy Facility Siting Council for the exemption. The effect of the exemption is to expedite the state facility review process by requiring the council to act on the exemption request within 60 days. There are many potential biodiesel and feedstock production facilities that are considering locating in Oregon. At least one of these could become the largest facility of its kind in the United States.
as Representative Boakes. A related bill, House Bill 3481, passed out of the Senate Revenue Committee earlier today. That bill would provide property tax exemptions, pollution control tax credits, and corporate and individual income tax credits to also encourage biodiesel facilities to locate in Oregon, and also to encourage the production and delivery of potential feedstock material for those facilities.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gordon Anderson, representative for District 3 in Josephine County. This is a very important bill, I think, to the state of Oregon in that it will allow companies to site in the state with a much a faster track than has previously been possible. You recall in our last biennium we did some shovel-ready sites for industry to get started outside the urban growth boundary and in some of the brownfield areas. And this is similar in that it allows biofuels facilities, both biodiesel and ethanol and even possibly methanol facilities, although that's not in the bill yet, to be sited here in Oregon. We have four or five different companies, groups, that are thinking about building plants, and they need to be able to get going as fast as possible. We took the contents of Senate Bill 736 and put them, as Mr. Hauser's place mentioned, placed it in House Bill 3481, and that did pass out today. But the importance of Senate Bill 736 is that it allows the bill to move quickly, and when finally worked passed and signed by the governor, it goes into action immediately, whereas in 3481, there is a taxation relationship to the bill, and that takes 90 days to be finalized. So this is an important bill on its own, but it also will be part of and more than likely merged with or taken out of, either way, House Bill 3481. But a very important bill, I think, as you'll hear from the technical testimony from the folks from OBEC, it will be a major benefit to the state should it and as it goes through.
Thank you,
gentlemen. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Larry Stevens with OBEC, Oregon Biofuel Engineering Company. Right now, we're in the process of looking at siting our facility in Oregon. We've been actively involved with Representative Anderson, Representative Krupp, Representative Dingfelder on watching 3481 and 736 take its course. We're here to support 736. We're at that position right now where we are ready to site. The problem that we're having is under the current law that's written for energy facilities, we're looking at a 2.5-year period before we can actually turn the spigots on. With 736, we can cut that down to 15 to 17 months. Economically speaking, that's massive for our company. The gain for Oregon to pass this bill, there's no revenue cost to Oregon to pass 736. But to allow us to site here allows for $180 million capital improvement within the state, $300 million worth of revenue over the next 5 years, 169 full-time family wage jobs, and that's in phase one and two. We have complete commitment from our investors to move forward. It's a matter of will you open the door and let us sit. We need 736 to move forward. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Al Herbst with OBEC. And I have similar comments and would ask that you move the bill forward to the floor for passage. There's, if you probably or maybe have seen in the press recently, there are of the last handful of plants that have been announced in the United States, most of them are over 20 million gallons. And there's a reason for that. And, of course, we need 736 in order to move forward with a large facility. There's also a reason why there are not 1 million gallon plants. And so again, the for Oregon, we would need Senate Bill 736 in order to move forward with a large facility. over the course of the last many months. There are many things that have been brought to our attention here that are important to the state and what the state wants in terms of jobs, revenue for the state, and also environmentally clean industry. This is a zero-waste facility. Improve Oregon's environment by cleaning up and helping to participate in, you know, school buses and so forth to make the environment better for citizens of the state. We want to be a leader in renewable fuels in the state. Can't do it without this bill. There is no cost for it, and so we would ask that you move this bill forward.
Okay. Any members, you have some questions?
Mr. Chair, could I just say one other thing, and that is that on January 27th, I believe it was, these gentlemen and other corporate officials met with the governor, and the governor was very, very optimistic about seeing this company come to Oregon and bring in $300 million each year from essentially Europe, where their present market is committed. And he said, I will get this through. We'll do it in 180 days. 180 days comes up on June 27th. And so we do need to be thinking of that hopefully we can meet the deadlines that their lenders are talking about, hopefully soon, either on or soon after the 27th. So appreciate your hearing this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Mike Graney, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. We also support Senate Bill 736. We mentioned just briefly that what this bill does is expand an existing exemption in current law. Currently, there's an exemption for ethanol production facilities from the normal siting process for large energy facilities made from certain agricultural materials if they meet certain conditions that limit environmental impact. Those conditions include already having received land use approval, include no need for major transmission line or pipeline additions, and in the case of ethanol facilities with the fuel components and the fuel itself going out of the plant are either barged or railed in, and that minimizes local traffic impacts in the facility. What this bill does is expand on that to include material for biodiesel facilities, and also expands the eligible materials for ethanol production to include cellulosic biomass, which would mean forest and farm waste. And so with that definition, I think it would also pick up methanol, as Representative Anderson suggested. This is a good bill. It would shorten the review time. Under this, excuse me, the company would come to the Siting Council to demonstrate compliance with the conditions. That would take probably no more than 2 months versus normally a review time of likely a year or more. And in fact, OBEC has already started providing us information so we could review the application so we can move quickly. Recommend your approval.
Any questions, Mr. Rainey? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 736 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 303.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 303 is creating the Office of Private Health Partnership by abolishing the current insurance pool governing board. It's transferring the duties, functions, and powers of the IPGB to the new office. It establishes that the new OPHP is under supervision of an administrator and authorized to administer and reorganize the office as necessary. You will notice that you have a fiscal impact statement attached to your staff measure summary. However, that just further clarifies that there is no fiscal impact to their current funding levels, that the changeover will be handled with their existing budget and position authorities.
Okay, Rocky King, please.
And also, Mr. Chair, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior record.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And as committee administrator summarized, and I'll kind of go through that real quickly, there are three things that this bill seeks to do. Again, abolishes the Insurance Pool Governing Board and creates a new office of private health partnerships. Two, it abolishes a seven-member policy board but provides for the administrator of the new office to create advisory committee or committees to provide policy and program consultation. And three, the bill clarifies our authority under statute and through administrative rule to provide aggregate data and information to the public as well as the legislature. Just to kind of give you a little bit of background, and I should tell you that the board has not taken a formal position on this legislation, but individually they have supported it. We didn't go to them and ask them to actually vote themselves from a policy making to an advisory role, but we do have a member of the board who would like to talk to her who's in the session today. IPGB was established in 1987 and had a budget of about $250,000 and seven-member board, no staff. This year, based on our budget proposals before both the House and the Senate, we're going to have about 52 staff and about a $93 million program. The role and responsibilities of the agency have far expanded over the last 14 or 15 years, and this is really why we've kind of brought this forth. We have three things that we do. First, we provide information to small businesses and individuals about health insurance options in both the private and public sectors. IPGB bridges between commercial markets of insurance and some of the public programs. The second thing we do is we do certify small employer health insurance plans so that small employers who do not provide health insurance, hopefully we can encourage them to get into the market and purchase health insurance and cover their dependents and their employees. And the third major thing is that we administer what's called the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is where we subsidize the purchase of private health insurance in both the group and individual market for low-income families between 185% of poverty on down. And it's kind of, again, the private sector part of the Oregon Health Plan. In 1990, through interagency agreement, we also share administrative staff and support staff with what's called the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool. If you have diabetes, multiple sclerosis, you earn enough money to purchase insurance, but no one will cover you. We're kind of the insurer of last resort. So again, we're kind of, I think Senator Westland said it well one time, we're the bridge between the public and the private sector. We really don't fit in some of the regulatory programs, for example, perhaps with Department of Consumer Business Services, and yet we really don't fit sometimes with DHS and their programs because of our ties to the private sector and what we try to do in terms of our agent referrals and working with small businesses. We think this is a good bill. It's going to help streamline some of the responsibility and authority from the legislature and the governor to the agency by having an agency administrator that's accountable to them as opposed to a seven-member board. That's a quick summary, Mr. Chair. I've been there for 14 years, and I can give you a lot more information if you'd like, but that, I think, is a good summary.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative McPherson studying over there.
but I don't have any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. That was all we had on that one. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 303.
And I believe that's all we've got today, isn't it? I think I went through by half the committee administrators in one day. We're adjourned. Thank you.